Hi everyone, and welcome to ITCC lecture number 7. Today we're going to discuss pointers once again. This is part 2, and we're going to discuss two more items, the new and delete operators, and also file input and output, although we're just briefly going to skim over that. And actually we have some exciting homework this week with file input and output, because we're going to be attempting to load in images. And I'll actually post a tutorial on how we might load in a PCX file or a bitmap file or whatever file spec I come across before then. So that means we can add on to our graphics library so far and actually incorporate some bitmaps if we want a picture in the background, or if we want some sprites or animations going on. Then we can use our new file input output routines to do that. So they say that I'm cutting out once more, so let me boost up my settings again, voice activation level. Alright, so this should fix the problem. Alright, so again, we have a really exciting homework this time. We're going to attempt to load in some files that contain images that we might make in Photoshop, or that we might make in PaintShop Pro, or even MS Paint. And once we load in these images, we'll be able to display them on our screen, hopefully using some graphics functions that we also write that have to do with the new and delete operators, which allocate memory dynamically. So on slide number 1, hopefully we can finish up with homework 3. We haven't gotten many submissions yet, but this is a difficult assignment, and the circle algorithm seems to be giving some people some troubles. So I'm going to post an explanation of that on the boards, or maybe just a link to a cool new site that I was referred to by Xylo. So get that in as soon as possible, and if you can't finish one of the functions, just fake it. I mean, the circle isn't really integral to later assignments, but if you get the line done, then that's pretty good, and that means you can complete Mystify as well. The circle's kind of there just for added bonus. So on to slide 3. First of all, we're going to do a quick review of pointers. So a pointer is always a 32-bit value, so it can store any number from 0 to 4 billion and some. And it's an unsigned 32-bit number. And remember that our smallest addressable memory unit in RAM is a byte. And a byte is 8 bits. It can hold a value between 0 and 255, for a total of 256 values. And this is the smallest addressable memory unit that we can access. So with a pointer with a 32-bit value, we can access 4 billion bytes, which is just over 4 gigs, and this is how we get that 4 gigabyte limit on RAM. So how do we initialize a pointer? Well, a pointer just contains a memory address, and that's all. So if we look at the example on slide number 3, then we have initialized the video buffer pointer to point to some address in memory. The 0x at the beginning means that the following number will be in hexadecimal, which we haven't talked about yet. Hexadecimal is just another base system, except it's base 16 instead of being base 2 or base 10. And with base 16, it has different letters in it. So A represents the letter A represents the number 10, the letter B 11, and so on up till F, which is the number 15. So and also, when we apply the void keyword at the beginning of video buffer, then void represents that we don't know what kind of data is stored at that address, but this is just some address we have. So void implies that I'm just storing an address in this pointer, and I don't know what it points to. However, on slide number 4, one way we can do it at the bottom, if we do know the data that we're pointing to, what type it is, then we can tell the compiler that this response pointer is pointing to a character. And even though there's a character in front of the pointer name, even though that care is there, we know that the pointer value will still be 32 bits, because all pointers are 32 bits long, because they all contain a 32-bit memory address. And this 32 bits might also change depending on your compiler and depending on the processor, but most compilers is 32 bits. So if we have a pointer and we want to assign a value to it, at the top of the slide we have video buffer equals some value. Well, this doesn't say to store that value into wherever video buffer points to. It says to store that value into the variable video buffer. So we're replacing the old address that video buffer pointed to the new address. So if instead of that 0xA000000, we had an actual variable, then it would replace the contents of video buffer with whatever was stored in that variable, meaning that only the addresses change. The contents of that address are left alone. And in any regard, it's tough to store a certain variable into video buffer because we don't know what type of data is stored there if we have a void pointer to it. So at the bottom of slide 4, again, we are saying that this response pointer points to a character of memory, or one byte. On slide number 5, one way to get the address of a variable, or where it's stored in memory, is by using the ampersand. So if I put an ampersand instead of in front of any variable, I'm getting the address that that variable is stored at. So even if I put an ampersand in front of a pointer, I'm still getting the address of where the pointer is stored at. Now, if we want to access the contents of a memory address of a variable or of a pointer variable, then I'll use the asterisk. And an asterisk placed in front of the pointer variable indicates, give me what's stored at that address in memory. So let's take a look at this little example here. Here we store a y value into the variable response. Response is declared as a character, meaning that it's one byte. And whenever we put single quotations around a certain letter or a certain character, then the compiler will convert that to its ASCII representation. So lowercase y has a certain value in ASCII, and the compiler will convert that lowercase y then to its value in ASCII, and then it'll store that number into the character variable response. So response is a one byte variable that's allocated in memory. So in the second line, we are allocating a pointer. A pointer is always 32 bits or 4 bytes. And we're initializing this pointer to point to nothing, or to point to null. Null is just a zero, and it implies that the pointer is not pointing to any memory address, at least no valid memory address. In this case, we have the character pointer to point to response. So that means whatever value in memory that pointer response points to, we're going to expect that will point to some character variable that's allocated as a character. In the third line, we are assigning an address to the pointer response pointer. And the address of that pointer is... The address of that pointer is going to be pointing to the variable response. So with the ampersand in front of response, we're grabbing the address in memory that variable response is stored at. And we're storing this address into our pointer. So pointers are supposed to contain addresses. So, on the fourth line, I don't think we put this in the last slides, but in this case, we're now putting the asterisk in front of pointer response. And because we put the asterisk there, we're referring to the contents of where this variable points to. So since the variable points to where response is stored, then we're going to store the value for n in the address of wherever response points to. So after that fourth line, if I ever access the variable response, now it's going to be an n. So do you see how that last line modifies the contents of response? I grabbed the address of the variable response, and then right after I grab that address, I'm writing to the contents of that address, and I'm writing the variable n. So this is actually going to modify what's stored in the variable response. And this is something that's really neat about variables, or about pointers, because it allows us to change the value of different variables without accessing the variable name itself. And this is important, for example, when we're sending pointers to functions. It means that we can send an address of a variable and thus modify the variable itself, instead of just making a copy of the variable and not having the chance of modifying the variable. So far so good. Another neat trick we can play is if we have a second pointer, we can set that pointer equal to pointer response without an asterisk. If we do that, then we set the address of this new pointer equal to the address of pointer response. And pointer response's address points to the variable response. So in essence, we'd have two pointers that are both pointing to response. So now if we use it, put an asterisk in front of either of those variables, then we're going to modify the value of response. So back onto slide number 6, let's review a little bit of pointer arithmetic. Another way that we can access arrays or access values in memory is to use some pointer arithmetic. And this is another kind of interesting idea. Let's take a look at the example to see if we can understand this. So I allocate an array of three variables, all of type long, and they're stored contiguously after each other in memory, right after the other. And in each one, there's one value stored. So in array index 0, there's 100. In array index 1, there's 200. And in array index 2, there's the value 300. Secondly, I'm going to allocate memory for a pointer. So in the top one, I allocated three longs, and each long is 4 bytes, for a total of 12 bytes of memory. For the pointer, I'm allocating a single block of 4 bytes, or that's 32 bits, because no matter whether I have a long or a car there, then I'm still allocating 32 bits. So I'm assigning the address of the first element, or the 0th index, of my val into the variable pointer long. So we're going to go to my val. We're going to find the first element of that, and then we're taking the address wherever that is. And then we're storing that in pointer long. So a second way to do this with arrays that I didn't mention last time is you could just say myVal instead of the ampersand and then the myVal element 0. And that saves some typing, because myVal really kind of points to the first value in the array, although it isn't a traditional pointer. There are distinctions between array pointers and just regular pointers. So now pointer long points to the first value in the myval array. So if I put a star or an asterisk pointer long, then that would refer to 100. Now I can use some pointer arithmetic here, and here's where it gets a little tricky. Now in the last line on that slide number 6, we have an asterisk, and then we're referring to the value in pointer long plus 1. Now when I say plus 1 here, I'm adding on 4 bytes. Notice that the pointer points to a long. We're assuming that there are a bunch of long values, or 4-byte values, stored at pointer long in right after each other, or contiguously in memory. So if I put a plus 1 there, then it'll advance 4 bytes automatically. And then after I add that 1 on to pointer long, then I evaluate the contents of that address and store it in new val. So in this case, it would be 200. So just as a little thought experiment, what if we took my val, or made a second pointer called pointer byte, and called it a car pointer? So we'd have car star pointer byte equals my val. So then that would point to the first value in my val, which is 100. And then let's say that we wanted to grab the 200 value just like we did with new val. So we have a long new val 2, and I just want to grab that 200 there. So I do the asterisk thing and pointer byte this time, but this time I'd have to add 4, because remember, my pointer byte is a character pointer, so I'm referring to 1 byte at a time. So this time, since these long values are allocated 4 bytes apart, because they are each 4 bytes long, I'd have to add a 4 onto the initial value to get to the 200. Hopefully that's a little clear. But you can use this stuff for practice when we get into storing bitmaps in memory. So on to slide number 7, let's take a look at some dynamic memory allocation. And this stuff's a little fun, especially when we get to allocating space for these bitmaps we're going to load in. Because the fact of the matter is, you have no idea before you open up the bitmap file how large these bitmaps are going to be that you're going to load in. So what we've been presenting so far has been static memory allocation. We've been reserving space for variables when the program begins instead of while it runs. And in the case of local variables, we might actually allocate those while the program's running. But with static memory allocation, the compiler takes care of everything. When we start up the program, it'll automatically allocate memory, and when we leave the program, it'll automatically free the memory. And that's a great thing, because it means that we don't have to micromanage things. So what if we don't know the size when we start the program up? So far we've been allocating arrays, we've been saying, oh, my array has 20 elements in it, or it has 5 elements in it. What if we don't know that beforehand? Well, then we're going to have to dynamically allocate the memory. So on slide number 8, how do we dynamically allocate memory? Well, in C++, we use the new operator. And in C, you might be familiar with the malloc command, which stands for memory allocate. And when we used malloc, we'd specify how many bytes we wanted to allocate. Well, the new command's a little different. In some ways, in fact, it's a lot easier than the C version, because you don't even have to remember how large certain variables are. So in this case, let's look at this very simple case. We have a character pointer to yes or no, and we're initially setting it to null, so it's not pointing to anything. So what the new command is going to do is that it will allocate some memory. In this case, we're saying allocate enough memory to store a character. So we're saying allocate a byte. So our software is going to go out, and it's going to look on RAM, allocate a byte of memory, and then return the address of that byte. And what better place to store that address than in a pointer, since that's what pointers were designed to do. Zeno asked us, is there any advantage to using malloc anymore? And the official word is you're not supposed to intermix malloc with the new command. Or not supposed to intermix C++ with C. at least in terms of memory management, because they use sort of different systems. But malloc could be easier if you're just allocating a random amount of memory. So I guess if you just wanted to allocate like 20,000 bytes, you could use malloc and just put in 20,000. In C++, you'd have to do new char and then 20,000 in brackets, like you were allocating an array. But I think either way, it's pretty easy. So I think you wouldn't have to use malloc anymore, because you can do the same things with malloc as you can with this new char. You can just put it the number of bytes you want to allocate in an array format. Alright, so the whole point of this is, remember that new will return a pointer to the newly allocated memory. Now, you might be thinking this is kind of redundant up here at the top. New character, we're just allocating memory for a character. I mean, you know, we could do this statically, even easier. So in this case, you'd probably do it statically, because we don't really need to dynamically allocate something that we already know how long it's going to be. So let's take a look at slide 9. And I have my character in the wrong direction, as was pointed out by M. So here's just a quick example of dynamic allocation and how it might be used. In this case, we are wanting to try to save some memory. And eventually we're going to have an array in memory that has all the sizes of all these bowls that we're going to get. So maybe we're a company that manufactures bowls, and we have a machine every day that sends bowls through the line. And every day we know how many bowls we're going to send through the line, we just don't know their sizes yet. And when they pass through our machine, the machine's going to tell us the size, and, you know, maybe we can store the size for later. So in this scenario, we're going to start out by asking the user, how many bowls do you need? And then the user will enter the number of bowls, and you need to switch around that the two left lesser than symbols in the cin command, and I'll do that later on tonight and post the new slide, because we're actually getting input from the user, character in. And now here's the tricky part. Now, I don't want to use any more memory than I have to represent all these bowls, because frankly, I have no idea how many bowls are going to go through this line. So there might be a billion bowls a day, or there might be just 100. So I'm thinking, you know, maybe for now I should just not guess at how and not put the maximum number of bowls in there. Because if there are a billion bowls, I don't want to allocate a billion bytes of memory, even though that's just... well, if there are a billion bowls and each is an int, then I guess it would be 4 billion bytes of memory, which is a meg. And it isn't that much. But if I have a lot of other large arrays, then I might want to do this dynamically. So in this case, remember that bowl size is a pointer to an integer, and that should be initialized to null initially, saying it doesn't point to anything. But in this case, I'm going to allocate an array. This is array notation. We just got numBowls from the user. So we're going to allocate an array of integers that has a length of numBowls. So this is allocating a bunch of integers that are all stored contiguously in memory, right after each other. And then once the computer has allocated that array, then it's going to send us a pointer to that area that it just allocated. And we're going to snatch that pointer and store it in bowl size. And then just as a quick representation of how you can use bowls, this new array, I'm just going to loop through however many bowls I have and set them all equal to 0, just to start out with. Because in C++ and in C, when we allocate new memory, it isn't guaranteed to be allocated to anything. So just as a quick sidetrack, you know, why is it not guaranteed to be allocated to 0? Because you'd think, you know, if I allocate new memory, why wouldn't I want it equal to 0? Well, it takes time to set all the new memory equal to 0. And there used to be an old C command called calloc, which cleared and allocated memory. But I don't believe that C++ has an equivalent command, because setting things equal to zero takes a lot of time for the processor. And if it can just go and snatch a region of memory and not have to clear it all to zero, then that's a lot more efficient for us. So I'm asked, what about zero memory? Zero memory is not a C++ command. Zero memory is Windows specific. So if you're doing Windows programming, then the Windows SDK provides commands such as zero memory and copy memory and stuff like that. But since we're just talking about C++ here, I think the only way to do it is just to loop through them and set them all equal to zero. So it's a lot faster for the computer to just snatch a region of memory and not have to clear it all to zero first. But if you look closely at the zero memory command, all that is it allocates memory, and then it uses a command called memset to set all the memory equal to zero very quickly. And I believe you can actually see the code they use to write zero memory. So all they're doing in zero memory is exactly what you do here. And if you wanted to automate this process, you could pretty easily by writing your own function. So on to slide number 10. One important thing about dynamic memory allocation is that you also have to dynamically deallocate the memory. There's something called a memory leak. At the end of your program, if you have dynamically allocated some memory and not freed it, then the operating system might never free that memory. Now, since you're using RAM, when you restart your computer, all the RAM is going to be reset. But if you don't free all of your memory and the operating system doesn't free it, then that memory it can't be used for any other applications, even when you close the application that you wrote. So this is memory that's been taken away from your RAM and just left there, not to be used by anything. So if you allocate memory, you have to be sure that you delete it. And remember again that if you statically allocate memory just by typing in a variable name, if you statically allocate it, then it's going to be freed automatically by the computer when your program terminates. And usually, however, if you do forget a delete command, it'll take quite a while for your RAM to be filled up. And in a lot of cases, the operating system will detect it and free it. But it's very good programming practice to dynamically deallocate all of your memory, too. And in fact, that's highly recommended. So just as an example on slide number 11, we're going to use the delete command, and delete is a key word, by the way, if you haven't recognized this. I highlighted all the key words in blue, or I at least tried to highlight them all. I might have missed some. But a key word just means you can't use it for a variable, and you can't use it for a function name, because it's reserved by the compiler. Like, you can't call a function int. So first off, we're going to try to delete our yes or no variable, very easy. Remember that we dynamically allocate a character into yes or no, and it's a single value. So we can just say delete yes or no, and that'll free the byte that we allocated for yes or no. And secondly, our bool size was an array of values. So we can also delete that entire array by placing two empty brackets in between the delete command and the variable name. So make sure when you delete an array that you use those brackets. Now, before we leave the new and delete commands, there are also ways of allocating two-dimensional arrays and three-dimensional arrays and so on and so forth. But you'll probably have to look those up on the internet for explanations, because they're a little more confusing than what I've demonstrated so far. Because you usually do have to know one value in advance and stuff like that. and the syntax is a little confusing as well. But if you're interested in doing that, feel free to look online. On slide number 12, on Game Dev's forums today, there's actually a cute little video on how pointers work on Stanford's site, and it's kind of fun, although it might be a little confusing to beginners, in my opinion, but, I mean, it's a fun way, and I don't really put a lot of illustrations on my slides, and I should, but illustrations take a while to make, if you want to make them well. And it helps a lot to visualize these things. So that's why I really encourage people to go out and look at a book sometimes, because they usually have illustrations. So it's an interesting little video. So let's do a quick example on slide number 13. So we have an uncompressed image, and each pixel is going to be 32 bits long, or 4 bytes. So what can we use this for? I'm allocating it as 640 by 480 with 32 bits per pixel. We could use this as like a background. We could use it as a double buffer, which, like I said last time, is somewhere where we'd write to and then quickly send it over to the video screen to reduce flicker. But in this quick example, I'm just saying the image height is 640, or the width is 640, the height is 480, number of bytes per pixel is 4. Oh my! And I actually made a small mistake here, so that I'll have to correct. I'll have to proofread these a little more. But we have an unsigned long pointer to an image buffer, but my mistake was down here when we dynamically allocated the memory. I'm allocating longs, so I'm automatically allocating 4 bytes of memory at a time. So if I was using the malloc command, which allocates a certain number of bytes, I'd put in this string here, image width times image height times pixel bytes, and that'll tell me the total number of bytes that I need to allocate for the entire image. But in C++, I'm allocating a long at a time. I'm allocating 4 bytes at a time. So this is even easier. I know that I'm allocating 4 bytes at a time, so I just need to put in the number of longs in here that I want to allocate. And the number of longs I want to allocate is 1 per pixel. So it's just image width times image height. So I can scratch out this pixel bytes one, since I'm not allocating it byte by byte. Now if I put in new char, then I would be allocating it byte by byte. So I'd need that pixel bytes to fully compensate for everything. So this would work, but I overcompensated for the memory by 4 times. So this would work if I was allocating a new character here, but I am doing a new long, and just to show off, this is one of the features of C++ that I failed to use here, because I could have just eliminated that pixel bytes variable at the end there. So now let's just get into a little file IO. This should be all that you need to, maybe you'll need a little more, to go into a graphics file and read stuff from that. So on slide number 14, just the basics of file input and output, it's fairly easy, and I think you'll find it as easy as writing to the screen. So we have a new header file that we're going to need to include. And in this case, it's called fstream for file stream. And in Visual C++, in Visual Studio .NET, we can't have the .h at the end, so afterward we're just going to include the using namespace std, which we haven't gotten into yet. So for now, there are just 2 basic types of streams that we can use: the output streams, which are OF stream, and the input streams, which are IF stream. And we can declare variables of both of those types. And again, there isn't a .h at the end of fstream, since we're using .NET, and the absence of a .h in this case refers to that we're using sort of the new C++ standards, where all of the standard libraries are encapsulated in the namespace std. And in fact, .NET will give you a warning if you do include the .h's. So this is sort of to avoid a warning. So on slide number 15, here's just a quick example of how to write to a file, and it's incredibly easy. We have an out sort of out file, and we're writing out to a file, and in this case I'm calling my file sample file.txt. And notice, first of all, that we're using OF stream, so this is an output file stream. And all I'm doing here is I just put in some text, my first file, and then I close the file, and bam, my file's written. And it has the text in it, my first file. So with those three lines, you know, I can make a file, I can write some text to it. One caveat is, whenever I use this OF stream, it's going to overwrite the old file. And there are actually several different ways to append the file, for instance, or if I wanted to only make a new file under certain circumstances, or if the file already existed, I don't want to write to it. All of these things are available to you. And we won't discuss them in the slides, but if you're interested, go online, and I actually include a link at the end of this section where you can find out some more about this. One of the really neat things about these stream operators is that at the bottom of slide 15, all I have to do to output a variable to a file is just put it inside, in between, two of the double less than symbols. So here I'm writing to the file, and I first of all write my first file, comma, and there are, and then I put in a variable name. And notice that it's surrounded by those two stream operators, and then eggs in a dozen. So I can string on a billion different variables on here, and it'll write every one in the file. Something else that's important to know is that if I write out a file in here if I write out a variable to a file using this method, that's going to write it in ASCII. So if I just open up the text file, I could read, it's human readable, I could read what the value of eggs in dozen is, because it's stored in ASCII. There's a second way to store these variables in files that's a lot more memory efficient, since it doesn't take up as much hard drive space. But I can also store the files in binary. And when I store them in binary, I'm actually writing the exact memory that's used to store if I allocate an integer, that's 4 bytes of memory, and I'm storing a 12 in it in this case. So if I'm writing to a binary file, it's actually going to store that number 12 inside 4 bytes of memory, exactly how it's stored inside the RAM. But if I output eggs in dozen in this out file here, it's going to convert that integer to ASCII. So it's actually going to output a 1 and then a 2, which is 2 bytes. But what commercial games often do to speed things up, if you save a game, they might take a huge chunk of their memory and just write out the entire memory block to your disk. And by outputting that entire memory block to your disk, that saves a lot of time because they don't have to parse it. They just load in the whole memory block, and it's stored exactly as it was stored in memory. So that's how we can achieve some of those really fast loading times. So we have a quick question here. Outfile is a function or an object you name? OF stream is sort of a class in C++, and this looks a little different from variables that you've seen before. But what happens with a class is, in this case, we're up at the top of slide 15. We actually have a variable type called OF stream, and this is actually a class, something called a class in C++. So our variable is actually outfile, and in parentheses, this is called a constructor. We're calling a function immediately when we allocate memory for this variable. And the function is an automatic function that's called immediately when we allocate memory for the variable. So again, OFStream is a variable type, kind of like int and char, except that it's something called a class. And our variable is called outfile. And then a function that we're calling immediately when outfile is created takes as a parameter samplefile.txt. And that function that we're calling is called the constructor. So that's automatically opening up the file. So on the second line, we're actually calling a function again. In this case, they overloaded that left stream operator there, is what it's called. They overloaded it. So that our file, so that when we're actually passing out file, this string, to a certain function that writes it to the file. But it's cleverly disguised here, so that we can use the left stream operator, so it's more convenient. But you don't have to worry about how all that's done yet. And then finally, we're calling a member function of outfile, sort of like we call functions using ITCC, except in that case we have a little arrow, and in this case we have a dot. And the arrow and the dot actually have things to do with pointers, but we'll get into those when we do classes. And Zeno also pointed out that we can have an OFStream Zeno Vives file equals new OFStream parentheses samplefile.txt. And that is also another valid way of doing it. But you need, for that to work, Zeno Vives file has to be a pointer. So you need OFStream star Zeno Vives file equals new OFStream samplefile.txt. And I mean, that's just as valid a method, but I think this one here, where you statically allocate memory for the class, is a little easier to understand to start out with. But Zenovieve's just pointing out that a second way we can do this, in this instance, we're statically allocating memory for outfile, but we can also dynamically allocate memory for outfile by using the new operator. And you can probably guess at how that works. So on slide 16, let's see how to read from a file. So one way that we can read from a file is by using the IFStream class. And IFStream stands for input file stream. So I'm calling it my in file. And let's say that I just have some number stored in the file. It's a text file. I just typed in a number, and then I close my file. And so I'm inputting a single value from the file called hit, and I'm storing it in the variable hit points. So again, this is very easy stuff. So I'm just saying in file, and then the write stream operator. I'm saying place whatever values in the file inside the variable hit points. So that's very easy and very straightforward. Then I'm as always going to close the file. And something else that in file can be called, it can also be called, instead of a variable, it can be called a file handle. And that's actually what it's called in Windows programming and what it was called in C programming. So in file can be a stream, it can be a file handle, a lot of different terminology to refer to files, but it's just another variable that is a class object, is what it's called in C++. But this is has a very similar structure to writing to the file, and just in case you're wondering how we would distinguish between several different numbers, like what if we had hit points and then we had stamina and stuff like that. If they're separated by white space, then the infile command will just ignore the white space and load in each number sequentially. So on slide 17, it's pretty tough to just explain all this file stuff right here, right now, and I don't have room on these slides. So again, I'm going to refer you to a website that talks a little more about file input output. It's actually a pretty good tutorial. I was impressed. And it'll talk about a lot of similar stuff to what we've been talking about, but it'll also go into a lot more depth. And if you want to append to a file, if you want to do some more complex reading ins of a file, all that stuff comes in handy. And it might come in handy for the loading in a bitmap homework too. So we'll have to see about that. But I think most of what you learned above, you'll be able to apply to the reading in a bitmap stuff. And I think that might just about be it that you'd need to know. There's also a function that you can call in the in file called .eof, which stands for end of file. And the function is just a flag, so it'll go off when you reach the end of the file. But that's also covered in the file input output. For example, if you're reading in a bitmap, you sort of don't know when it's going to end, you might just keep reading in values through the file until the end of file function is flagged and tells you that you've reached the end of the file. That's one way to do it. So then on slide 18, we're going to look at a quick example, you know, how our program might write out a file and then how we might read that file back in later. So these file things are pretty handy, like if you want to make a high score list or something like that. And in fact, I've made a high score list before using file functions similar to these, just tacked it on to the end of another file. But so at the top here, we'd want to write some player statistics out. So we're going to write them out to samplefile.txt, and I have player health, player stamina, and player magic. All three of these should be initialized to some value before we get down to this outfile routine. I mean, very easy stuff. I'm going to output the health, and then I'm going to output a space, and then the stamina, then a space, and then the magic. And if you open up this file using Notepad or something, you'll clearly be able to read all three of these because they're all stored in ASCII. And note that they're all separated by spaces. If they weren't separated by spaces, all the numbers would be merged together and we wouldn't be able to tell what's going on. So then we're going to close the file. How are we going to read these back in? Well, we're going to use ifstream this time and have an in file. And also note that if we're going to be doing this at the same time, there are also ways of getting a single variable that is both an input file and an output file. You don't have to segregate them like this, but doing it this way just makes it a little easier. You can just type in the file name and go with the flow. But in this case, all we're going to do is read in three values. So it'll read in player health, then it'll skip white space, read in player stamina, skip some more space, and then read in player magic into those three variables. And that's all you have to do, is store some simple values to a file. So, that's pretty simple. And actually, for the image assignment that we're going to try to do for next week, we're actually going to try to read in a binary file, and I haven't said anything about those yet. So we'll have to look at that too. Maybe I'll post a link to a good tutorial, or maybe we can use the tutorial that we posted on slide 17. But all in all, it's pretty much the same thing. File handling is pretty straightforward once you get it down. So finally, on slide number 19, it looks like some people are still struggling with ITCC homework 3, which may be in part my fault, since I did screw up a few times. But we're going to have ITCC homework 5 posted soon, in today or tomorrow, or maybe even the day after that. I hope, or maybe that's number 4. But in any regard, we're going to have the next homework available soon. But we're just hoping to get people through the last homework and make sure that they're up to speed before we release a solution to it. And again, if you don't have the circle function done, look at the site that Zeno posted. I'll post that on the forums, or Zeno can. And maybe I'll write up some more about it if the site isn't adequate. But the circle thing is a little tough to do because you can't just copy the code that they have and expect it to work. I think that's what a lot of people try. But even if you don't have the circle done, it isn't integral to the assignment as long as you get Mystify done and everything. So, that's pretty much it. If you can't find something or if you can't figure out something, look online. There are billions of sources on there that explain these things because this is just introductory C++. So you'll find lots of really good tutorials, much more than my slides can do justice to. So again, thank you for coming to this lecture number 7, and I guess I'll talk to you next week. Have fun.